You know that thing where the news used to slow down in July and August? Yeah, not that. This week, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 23rd of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are just going to dig right in. 5 days in this economy, or six, maybe 7 minutes worth of your time. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and I guess we're going to get a little analytical here right off the top. You know how the debate has been whether inflation is going to be transitory or not, and we're going to have to wait some time to figure out whether that's true. I wonder now, with the stories that we've seen this week in the papers and we've done on this radio program about rising rents and people really starting to feel it, I wonder if maybe we're at the point where we're kind of starting to know about inflation.
Well, rents, well, shelter in general is a major component of one of the main measures of inflation, the consumer price index. And so, yes, rising rents are worrisome, and that reflects presumably both cyclical factors, you know, the fact that people are moving back to cities as cities are reopening and they're ready to start renting apartments again, move out of their parents' basements or whatever. But there are also some structural problems, too, including the fact that we probably underbuilt in a lot of parts of the country over the last couple of decades. And millennials are hitting childbearing age and need places to live. They want to move out of their parents' houses. They want to ditch the roommates, et cetera. So that will push some upward pressure on inflation that could, you know, that's again, some of which is pandemic related, reopening related, and some of it has to do with these broader forces in the economy. That doesn't necessarily tell us about all of the other supply bottlenecks and reopening pains and frictions that we're seeing right now that are unrelated to rents and are unrelated to underbuilding. So that kind of still remains to be watched closely.
Okay.
Shall we say.
Yep, fair enough. Now, Gina, let's do the flip side of that coin, and that is that the Delta variant, while not in charge of this economy, is making its feelings known, shall we say.
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, there are some real questions about what that is going to mean for the economic trajectory. You know, there are, I think, two schools of thought here. The first is that this is bad news. You know, if the Delta variant continues to surge, if we see it keep many nations around the world partially shut down, and if it leads to renewed shutdowns here, we are in trouble. I think the, you know, sort of more optimistic take on it is that we've got much higher vaccination rates than we've seen in previous waves of the virus. The places that aren't vaccinated didn't really shut down in the first place. And so while the human cost here could be pretty significant, the economic cost might be more limited than what we've seen in previous waves. And so I think those are sort of the sort of run the gamut in economic projections, but
yeah, no, look, that's totally fair. But Catherine, I'm obliged to point out, we're going to get the first look at second quarter gross domestic product next week, right? Everything that this economy produces. And it's going to be like 8.5%, which is just enormous.
Yes, that is huge growth, historically very high pace of growth. You know, I think you're referring to annualized, but
yeah, of course.
But yes, would be tremendous. Of course, we are digging our way out of a very deep hole, and those numbers partially reflect some temporary fiscal stimulus that was pumped into the economy last year and earlier this year. And the question is, what happens with all of these lingering risks, like the Delta variant? Maybe there won't be as much of an economic impact for the reasons that Gina points out, but we just don't really know yet. So even if we have, you know, a really rapid growth this past quarter, what does the rest of the year look like? What does next year look like, particularly if we can't get the pace of vaccinations back up?
Mm-hmm. Gino, another nod to next week's calendar. The Federal Reserve meets. Chair Powell will hold a press conference at which various and sundry questions will be asked, some/many of which will be about what has come to be called the taper, when the Federal Reserve is going to pause or slow down its buying of securities, bonds and securities. Briefly, because I don't want to get too far into the taper, and one prognosticates with the Fed at one's own risk. What's your sense of what he's going to say, given what we know now about the variant and all of these other things?
It is going to be an adventure to be Jay Powell next week.
There's a Fed reporter right there. It's going to be an adventure.
Yeah. I mean, to be a fly on the wall at this meeting, they are definitely going to have quite a robust debate about what they need to do, because I think you're going to have folks on one side saying, whoa, guys, this Delta variant looks a little scary. We're not confident about the economic outlook anymore. Things are getting a little hazy. And then I think on the other hand, you're going to have these folks who are like, no, wait, inflation is taking off. We need to get going. We need to dial back support for the economy. And so it's going to be Jay Powell's job to come out and kind of sum that all up in a way that is somewhat cohesive and coherent for financial markets. And so that is going to be fun for him. And I imagine what we'll hear is something to the effect of, we're still talking about, you know, slowing down our bond purchases. We're getting ready. We're poised. We're prepared for whatever comes next. And, you know, we're not going to let inflation take off, but we're also not going to let the economy tank. And so it's going to be an exercise in threading that needle.
As the guy does every time he steps out in public. Catherine, super quick on the way out here. I want to point out that we are once again about to embark on a discussion of the debt limit. And oh my goodness, is the United States going to default on its debt, and it's going to get politicized, and everybody's going to go, oh my goodness. And then, you know, at the 11th hour, they're going to say, oh yeah, no, of course we'll raise the debt limit. Right?
I hope that's, I mean, that is a optimistic scenario. But well, hopefully the scenario we get, yes, we go through this regularly scheduled hostage crisis, like, right, you know, every year or so. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, has said he doesn't believe a single Republican will vote for a so-called clean debt ceiling increase, that Democrats are going to have to include it in their reconciliation package, which has a lot of other stuff that Democrats are internally fighting over. So, you know, I hope we don't come to the brink of a financial crisis, but we have in the past, you know, about a decade ago. Yeah. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I hope this doesn't happen. Whether it takes to the very last minute, as you suggest, or they do something in advance, which I think is very unlikely to happen, those would definitely be better scenarios than, you know, the United States defaulting on its debt, which is obviously the very last thing anyone needs right now.
The very last. Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Gina Smilek at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, look, I'll tell you, Delta Schmelta. Record highs all over again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's pretty clear the bigger businesses in this economy are doing all right. Earnings season has been proof enough of that. But consumers feeling good, as we are, and having cash, as we do, and being vaccinated, as many but not enough of us are, is especially good news for small and medium-sized businesses that got hammered last year. And a lot of them are coming back. That's according to new data from Yelp. The company reports the second quarter of the year, April through June, had the fastest pace of business reopening since last spring, led, as you might imagine, by restaurants and retailers, with home improvement and auto repair not far behind. And also, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, a record number of new businesses opening up.
Something like 15 to 20% of small businesses likely didn't survive the pandemic. But those that did are reopening at a frenetic pace, says Justin Norman, head of data science at Yelp.
Over 60,000 businesses reopened, which is the highest volume of reopenings in the last year.
And Yelp finds something interesting about where the business buzz is strongest.
Distinct correlation between the vaccination rate and vaccination completion in an area and the number of reopenings and consumer interest.
So more Yelp searches and pictures and reviews of stores and restaurants in places like Maine, Vermont, Connecticut, New York. Where there's less vaccination, there's less consumer interest.
So places like Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, but also some places in the West, such as Arizona, where vaccination rates are unfortunately low.
What's really strong all over the country is new business openings. Catherine Petralia is co-founder of small business finance firm Cabbage, now part of American Express.
We know that 2020 had a record number of new business starts, period. People who were furloughed from their job took the opportunity to start their own business. You see this happen in every economic cycle after the recession.
New firms are in most every sector, from restaurants and food carts to landscaping, construction, salons, and gyms. Ray Sanza at small business software firm Homebase says a lot of the founders have this in common.
These owners tend to be younger, a little bit more tech savvy. So out of the gate, the zero stage build has technology in the DNA.
Meaning, he says, they're built lean with mobile online ordering and pickup and delivery and labor-saving apps to keep their costs and need for new employees to a minimum. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On the very long list of things we all worried about during the pandemic, I am just going to say that parking was probably not one of them. What we needed was more space for those little huts that kept us and our food warm when it was 40 degrees out, but you couldn't take one more night in. Also, special spots reserved for the DoorDash driver and curbside pickup. And honestly, that was an easy trade-off. But traffic is now back, and in some places, it's as bad as it used to be. In others, it's worse. And parking spaces, they are not back. Welcome, then, to your new old headache, as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
I used to live in a part of Sacramento where street parking was pretty scarce. But late at night, Salvation was right around the corner. In front of Beast and Bounty, I would pull into my special spot outside the restaurant and move my car the next day. But when I drove there this morning... Okay, I'm going to put my hazards on, because there's no place to park here. Now there's a delightful outdoor eatery. And Sacramento has a strong reason to keep it that way, says Jonathan Wicks with the urban planning firm Walker Consultants.
A restaurant that's turning tables and selling food and drink service and what previously, you know, was occupied by a 2 or 3 ton vehicle, that brings in more revenue to the city.
So does takeout and curbside pickup. The New York Post reported in May that the city had lost 8,500 parking spots to pandemic outdoor dining. But parking at the office garage? Not a problem.
We're seeing clients and customers saying, look, I'm not going to park 22 days a month anymore at my office.
This is where the parking apps are stepping in. Neil Golson heads up marketing for Flash, a platform that connects parking lot owners with people who need space.
One of our customers has several office buildings in Orlando, really close to downtown Disney.
The offices hadn't reopened, but Disney World had, so they opened the lots for tourists. All right, gotta go. I'm double parked. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
I know we're in the middle of July and life's supposed to be slower now. Vacations maybe, or maybe work's at least a little bit less crazed. But if you're in retail, buckle up, because this is the time of year when consumers start looking for pens and marble notebooks and three-ring binders, hand sanitizers and masks this year probably too, and parents dragging kids to the store to buy clothes that actually fit. Deloitte expects back-to-school spending to hit $32.5 billion with a B dollars for K-12 this year, works out to $612 per student. But as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, there is a lot going on that makes this back-to-school season different and less predictable.
A lot of kids went to school remotely last year. So like a lot of us adults, they could get away with wearing pajama pants or shorts.
That happens for school, too. You know, business on top and party on the bottom.
That's Tracy Hurley in Naperville, Illinois. Now, being a growing teenager, her 13-year-old son doesn't fit in his old pants, so she's going to have to buy him clothes for the school year. The same is true for Janelle Domeyer in Omaha, Nebraska, and her 15-year-old twin boys. Their school had hybrid classes last year.
I expect to buy more clothes because they will be there every single day.
One thing she says will help, the expanded child tax credit. People are now getting more money from the federal government if they have kids, and they're getting it up front. For Domeyer, it's an additional $500 a month.
I think it will affect how I spend just in terms of I won't have any anxiety over any increased cost or buying extra clothes that they will need.
Also, a lot of families got stimulus checks over the past year and have saved up money. Rod Sides is a vice chairman at Deloitte.
So generally, when you see savings rates go up and we get into a season, usually consumers will spend a little bit more.
So there are lots of reasons to think people will spend more money on back to school this year. But remember that problem we've been telling you about with supply chains? Sonia Lipinski is a managing director at Alex Partners.
Retailers continue to struggle to get product in for varied reasons. There's still supply issues in different countries because countries are grappling with COVID.
It's not clear if people will be able to buy everything they want for the school year. And with prices going up, whether they'll be willing to pay what it costs. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
There are times, we know, when you can't hear the broadcast. We got podcasts. Can help you out. Your platform of choice will have it. Coming up.
We do think about our busy season.
That's a good idea. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 238 points today, just shy of 0.7%. 35,061, the first close over 35,000 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up 152 points, just over 1%, 14,836. The S&P 544 points to the good, 1%, 44.11 there. For the week, the Dow up just over 1%. NASDAQ added 2.8%. The S&P 500 gained 1.9%. Remember Monday? That big swoon? Yeah. Data released by IHS Market today says the market's rise this week was helped by upticks in both private sector business and manufacturing output in June. Looking at some manufacturing stocks then. Deere & Company up 0.9%. GE was basically flat. American Axle up 1.6%. Virtual life on social media soared during the pandemic, as you know. Twitter and Snap both released strong earnings today. Snap up 23%. Twitter picked up 3%. 10-year Treasury note, just because we're keeping an eye on that, 1.27%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is the thing about all the big wildfires burning out here in the West right now. 83 of them as of today, says the National Interagency Fire Center. The thing is that it's not even supposed to be fire season yet. September and October were fire season back in the day, and then the planet started getting hotter and drier, and here we are. Last year, what was till that point the worst West Coast fire season ever carried insurance costs of anywhere from $7 to $13 billion. That's from a firm called Risk Management Solutions. So the economic incentive to figuring out how those fires spread is pretty high. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jess Burns has the science.
At David Blunk's farm near Albany, Oregon, the soundtrack is positively pastoral. A rooster is kind of the last thing you'd expect to hear when there's a scientific experiment underway. But in a small clearing next to a freshly planted field of vegetables, the Oregon State University engineer and his team are setting out frames of white cloth. They're spaced on the ground in growing semicircles, like lawn chairs at an outdoor concert. The cloth is there to catch firebrands or flying embers when they land.
For how much of a tree or shrub burns, what's the number of firebrands that'll be released? That's the big value that we're trying to back out.
Despite their importance in spreading fires, relatively little is known about how many firebrands different kinds of vegetation generate during a wildfire.
Obviously, if you want to better understand how to control it or contain it or prevent it, it's helpful to know how it spreads.
To do this, Blunk and his team are burning different trees and shrubs, a lot of them, from Douglas fir to sagebrush. Today, it's a bush called chamise, which can be found in California and southern Oregon. Their work is funded by a $200,000 federal grant. Engineer Sampath Adusumili is leading the burns, propping up chamise branches above a pile of straw at center stage. He grabs a handful of the straw, letting individual bits drop and be carried by the breeze.
We'll just wait a little bit. This is our scientific wind direction testing.
The pieces drift towards the cloth frames on the ground.
That's good. Yeah, I think we're ready.
They light the dry straw on fire, and within seconds, the bushy chemise goes up like a torch. Threads of embers swirl up into the heat-distorted air. In an actual wildfire, Blunk says knowing how many firebrands are produced could eventually be used to help firefighters and communities understand how the fire will behave.
Where will the firebrands go, and what's the likelihood they'll start a new fire?
Almost as quickly as the experimental burn started, the fire dies. Embers have fallen onto the cloth frames, leaving scorch marks behind. These marks will be counted to make comparisons between plant species. In addition, Blunk and his team are burning different size trees to compare how tree age affects how many embers are generated. Their preliminary findings have been unexpected. The data suggests that for each kilogram burned, larger trees produce fewer firebrands than smaller ones.
And we're not sure if those trees happen to have more moisture content, or maybe the structure of the tree, maybe there's just fewer of the fine twigs or needles to break off. And we're scratching our head about that one.
And as climate change brings longer, drier fire seasons to the West, state leaders and forest managers are doing a little head-scratching as well. How do we best prepare communities for the ever-increasing risk of wildfire? They may be surprised to find one part of that question is being answered on a little farm in Oregon. In Albany, I'm Jess Burns for Marketplace.
Mitchell was talking about new data from Yelp a little bit earlier, how it shows businesses bouncing back pretty good, including if you read down a bit in that data, in the state of Maine, where the vaccination rate is high and there is consumer activity to match. So for today's installment of our series, My Economy, a dispatch from Kristen Thalheimer Bingham. She is the co-owner of Dean's Suites in Portland, Maine.
We've had kind of crazy growth just in the past 6 weeks. We've gotten through it, but we need more people to help with customers, more people to help make the chocolate, more people to help tie little pretty ribbons on boxes. Everybody's hiring right now, and so it's a really tight market for that. There's a really wonderful coffee shop nearby, and they're looking to hire, you know, three people. And down the street, there's a wonderful women's clothing store, and they're looking to hire two people. So there's a lot of demand out there right now for good people. I'm definitely concerned about keeping the people we currently have. We try to pay them as best as we can, and we try to give them benefits. I try to kind of read between the lines whether somebody's feeling a little antsy. And I haven't seen that, thankfully. You know, I kind of pay attention to it. And, you know, knock on wood many times over, that right now the folks that we've had for many years are still happy and interested in the job and interested in staying with us. So I hope that continues. We do think about our busy season, which is coming right up. August is a very busy month here in Portland, Maine, and then September, even more so with people traveling through New England. And then it's straight into the holidays, and we need to prepare as much as we possibly can now so that we're ready. I think we're going to be, if I can tell by what's been happening recently, that it's going to be a much bigger year for us than either 2020 or 2019. So the more that we're ready and prepared now, the more we'll be able to do with a little bit less stress, I hope.
Or a lot bit less stress. How about that? Kristen Thalheimer Bingham running a chocolate shop up in Portland, Maine. You know, we cannot do this series without you. So do let us know how things are going, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, in which hard seltzer maybe your time has gone. The seltzer craze kind of came out of nowhere a couple of years ago. You remember White Claw, right? And then before you knew it, everybody was making the stuff. Yeah, here come the regrets. Boston Beer, which makes Sam Adams, that's a beer, announced earnings yesterday afternoon after the close. Said CEO Dave Berwick, the company overestimated the growth of the hard seltzer category and demand for Truly, that is their hard seltzer. Ticker symbol SAM, Sam, get it? Anyway, down 26% to date. Too much seltzer. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context, which comes with two warnings. Number one, caveat emptor. And number two, please, please, please consult your own financial advisor. This item from researchers at the University of Chicago, 13% of Americans have traded cryptocurrency in the past year, which, look, it's your money, right? Just be careful out there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.